Thus can be seen the distortion in Dugin's philosophy, which is completely Luciferian as is his political praxis, which is a direct result of this and which is represented as influencing Putin's the political figurehead of the cabal's left-wing left-hand path to be played off against the right-wing right-hand path. Hence the ideological war is simultaneously a spiritual, a racial and in mundane political war, with the earth being the colosseum of this perspective gladiatorial contest between rival factions whose organic differences are amplified by the Jews through their ideological spiritual mind programs of religion, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, i.e. right-hand path pacifistic reactionary programs, Islam, quotes Satanism, quotes Taoism, i.e. left-hand path aggressive action-oriented mind programs and their subordinate secular forms of right-wing and left-wing. The war to end all wars plays into the religious quotes and times quotes eschatology in all regions reflective of the divine will and the cycles of time in the Kali Yuga. Dugin and his cabal are undoubtedly attempting to co-opt or rather spin this eon exchange in their favor as a final act of black magic in their gambit to have hegemony over the world. The Slav within the pro-white movement and historically in race relations amongst peoples, those who have come to be referred to as Slavs have been a question mark in the minds of others not Slavic. Specifically as it concerns the Nordic, more Aryan elements, the Slavic type has been forever a question. Are they, the question is so often phrased, white or Aryan, or are they instead rather un-Aryan and not white at all? Are they not instead Eurasian, these Far East Europeans, and if so, is it merely a question of degree of proportionality to justify qualifying them as white or not white? The Slav remains a tertium quid, a question mark in the mind of the racial scientist or philosopher, the racialist, and it is the writer's intention here to amplify the meaning of the East European and to make lucid the opaque glass through which this figure is typically perceived. The East European is a variable figure, and this variability is what makes of him an enigma in terms of racial classification. Eastern Europe is a geographical region comprised of many nation-states which themselves are not wholly bound up with a particular nation in the proper sense of the word, but are an as it were tumultuous concatenation of nations which have been confined within the ever-changing borders of nation-states over millennia, sometimes expanding and at others contracting while having their ethnicity also undergo protean change owing to the invasion of other ethnicities. Thus it can be properly spoken of Eastern Europe and East Europeans by extension as a protean organism admitting of change and yet paradoxically remaining the same. Indeed, this is the enigma, the paradox of the East European in a nutshell. Zooming out to a God's eye perspective, taking into the mind the sensatu of history and the entire geographical region in question, we may acknowledge that those areas of Eastern Europe furthest from the Asiatic countries are, all things being equal, the least Asian Mongoloid and most European Aryan white and vice versa, and that those areas of this region closest to others are again, Caterus Paribus, most like those other regions, be they Austria, Italy, Czech Republic, Germany, etc. Hence as an example we can observe the Hungarian being more akin to the Austrian but only relatively, e.g. to the Ukrainian, and yet, owing to the influx of gypsy stock containing an admixture thereof and thus perhaps less Aryan than the Ukrainian in spite of Hungary's closer proximity to the West. The tumultuous history of Eastern Europe results in a tumult of peoples who are strengthened through the conflicts of the ages while simultaneously undergoing modification through these oppositional forces, through assimilation of other elements in e.g. defeats in battles spanning millennia and or the voluntary assimilation of those foreign elements leading to greater decay of the nation. The more inhospitable regions, owing to barrenness and remote inaccessibility of climate, led to a greater segregation from mixture and especially in those of closest proximity to Central Europe. Hence places such as Latvia, Estonia and the East Baltic region are more Aryan and pure, adjusted for mixture with the Finno-Ugric stock, the Russian with the Mongol stock, and the pressure of greater forced mixing through the forced migrations of the Slavs under the Soviet Union, especially within Russia itself, and the genocidal decimation of the Germanic stock in the tens of millions by the Jewish Bolsheviks. Thus the Slav is born and was conceived in the mind of Jewry as early as the Byzantine Empire, which latter degenerated into modern Turkey, the menace which sits on the doorstep of Europe. The Slav, or better stated East European, is thus a being which admits of much variation and incorporates elements that give impetus to forms of behavior and cognition that are quite divergent from that of the more pure Aryan stock. However, they lend a more lyrical and perhaps even soulful character, soulful in the sense of A. Voller's classification from his work Synthesis of Racial Doctrine as a Demetrian character or soul type. The lyricism of their traditional music and dance is reflected in the poetry and literature as well as in the mythos of the traditional folkways which have managed, in spite of the imposition of the Abrahamic mind virus by the sword, to remain Aryan in the Indo-European sense and hence still East European, becoming differentiated via the particular racial soul of the subtypes of this more abstract geographical label, those types who dwell within these regions and who have formed a distinct culture as a result of their lived experiences in these regions. Indeed, Latvia was one of the last regions of Europe to be yoked to the Semitic torture machine of the Catholic Church, and the people have not had their consciousness as deeply imprisoned in the matrix of Abraham as have those areas closer to Rome. Those areas within reach of Jewish-controlled Rome have served as a base of operations by the inventors of the Abrahamic Creed, such as England, Holland, France and Germany to a lesser extent, the latter being the perpetual bone of contention which has assisted in repelling the influence of Catholicism but in the process spreading the virus of Protestantism via Luther, et al. Paradoxically, this has led to the disintegration of Catholicism. Eastern Europe, perhaps owing to the tenacity of foreign elements introduced within its blood, has acquired a perhaps greater capacity of resistance to the Semitic inoculation of the virus of Abrahamism and, perhaps owing to that same admixture now inextricably welded to the type and formative in part of that type, it has enabled a retention of the healthier instincts which, especially in the case of Britain and its imperial colonies, has been to a great extent weakened through the millennia of spiritual infection. An example of this Western spiritual syphilis can be seen in the moralizing fetishism of Western society, its bad conscience, guilt, shame and other signs of a sick mind, behavior largely absent in the East European. The remote north of Scandinavia also bears witness to the preservation of tradition over and against Abrahamism, however the relative purity of the stock perhaps makes it less resistive and more delicate in susceptibility of such infection. As Nietzsche said, the noblest and purest animals are often the most susceptible to extinction. The strengthening influence of the presumed Asiatic or Oriental blood infusion from Asia and the Mediterranean into the East European stock has had a degenerative influence in many cases, and also as a saving grace from the perspective of Ross in Hygiene, a strengthening influence perhaps kindling in the mind the fire of the blood memory of the ancient Hyperborean stock. Those purest are often least conscious of their purity, taking it for granted and thereby failing to safeguard it from contamination. Those less pure, though still white, still predominantly Aryan in terms of the proportion of their Aryan blood, are more vigorous in fighting to retain that Aryan blood they have and indeed to purify it yet further through sound eugenics either within their own kind or through crossing with those of purer kind, such as in the case of East Europeans with those of Central, Western or North Europeans. The apathy of the West is largely attributable to the mind virus of Christianity. The comparative healthy-mindedness of the East European may be considered to derive from the following causes: 1. A lack of Christianity. 2. The constant threat of assault from the Asiatic East and Arabic South. 3. The slight admixture of blood from the foreign stocks who presumably either have ceased to exist, being mixed together, or who have been beaten and defeated or at least beaten back, leaving whatever remnant now exists in those regions. The Slav has his quixotic nature, as can be seen in the work of Dostoyevsky and Gogol amongst others, his chaotic character and the sardonic wit that forever plays about his features, a survival mechanism. This may be attributed to a life of struggle against foreign invasion and the necessity of perpetual war, his temperament being one of perseverance in adversity and strength through joy and joy through strength. The East European has served as the vanguard against incursion into Europe and, in spite of his perhaps fatal flaws, he deserves to be dignified with the title Aryan. Slav life, trad life. The perpetual discussion in the Altkirche alt-right regarding Slavs and their tradition, typically in the form of Russia and its Orthodox Christianity, may be reasonably assumed to be designed to achieve the following purposes. to create a false association between pro-whites and Russia as a nation-state such that pro-whites in non-Russian countries can be associated with a soon-to-be enemy nation and to be declared enemy combatants. They would then be subjected to Guantanamo Bay-style torture and/or elimination by the police state of the GRG such that the state can justify the acceleration of its fourth-generational warfare program against their own slave populations, leading to their endgame of white genocide and global despotism. The SOP of the Trad-Slav is deployed to mind control and neutralize pro-whites by attempting to subject them to the mind control of Christian dogma, which is a black magic formula for mental slavery and subordination to jury. This is achieved through the presentation of the Slav and Slavic culture as traditional when, as Julius Savola stated in several of his works, Christianity is not an authentic tradition but a form of garbled syncretism of lunar Semitic Near Eastern spirituality that was combined with the solar Uranian authentic spiritual tradition of the Aryan and formed a pragmatic amalgam that was used by Jewry to weld together the disparate populations of Rome and to create a mongrelized product of the original Roman stock and Near Eastern and Mediterranean traders servile to the Jewish oligarchy. Hence the Orthodox tradition is an oxymoron and an absurdity which was imposed in characteristically Jewish fashion on the Russian Empire in the same way Catholicism was imposed upon Rome. The Tsars were typically bound up with Jews, and this via miscegenation or affiliation in the conventional forms of usury and finance, and tied together through occult and religious bonds. Those who have fallen for the lie of the Trad-Slav have merely embraced a syncretic construct, a simulacral idea, and have assisted in bringing it into being through lending it support. The true tradition of East Europeans is as foreign from that SOP as the Western, Northern and Central Europeans are from Catholicism and Protestantism. Christianity is the spiritual syphilis which has rotted out the body of the white man and which, rather than serving as a life preserver, is in fact a life destroyer, a leaden anchor which seeks to submerge him within the corrosive waters of the illusory world, the matricized fake world of Jewry. To discover the actual tradition of the East European, one must look before Christianity cursed the earth with its presence and consult the myths which predated it and understand the relationship between East and North, Central and Western Europeans. Such a task is no easy one, but still lives in the region in the form of authentic culture which has had to be concealed from the sight of the perpetually witch-hunting Christian censor and their Jewish mind manipulators to avoid being destroyed by the cabal of evil which still shrouds the world in darkness. Tradition can be discovered in the cultures which have put up the greatest resistance to the Jewish hegemony, and that lies in the West but in the East of the West, and not in the false cultural constructs which Jewry has installed in these regions as Trojan horses to tear apart these nations via miscegenation and destroy their authentic traditions. The soul of the East European, erroneously named Slav, lives on in spite of the relentless assault by the robots of the Demiurge, Jewry and their fellow black magician Christian priest underlings. Should the prognostication of James Battersby in his The Holy Book of Adolf Hitler fructify, we will see arise under the aegis of the folk soul of Aryan mankind a union formed of the Nordic, Germanic, Celtic and East European subtypes of the descendants of the Hyperborean Aryans. The disgrace of work, the distinction between classical virtue and virtue as understood under the regime of the Piscean Age, that being Christian virtue is wholly distinct. It is the distinction between the master morality of the ancient world oriented around strength, power, beauty and true divinity, the divinization of man in a healthy relationship with the gods, and that of the slave morality of the Judeo-Christianity, wherein all of that which is low and the base, defective and inferior is exalted with the creed "the last will be first and the first will be last." Oswald Spengler called Christianity the grandmother of Bolshevism, and both derive from the same source, that being the Jew. The Jew embodies the soul type of the Shandal, who emanates from out of his soul the creed of slaves, of the servile and passive aggressive weak and invalidic type of being. This is not to say that he has not in many instances managed to overcome his own inner deficiencies, but simply to underscore the point that these defects are the wellsprings from which issue forth the tears of pathos of the somatic type, and which have crystallized in the form of the religions and ideological creeds of slave morality. Slave morality of the necessity exalts the figure of the slave and inverts the morality of the master as an act of vengeance on the part of the slave, a slave rebellion in ethics and Weltan's Hu Wang over and against that which coerces and obligates him to labor. Thusly the slave finds solace in his base condition. He finds a sense of dignity and indeed of veneration for his ego through positing himself as the standard. This is typically clothed in the raiment of false humility before that which is alleged to be superior to himself, namely the absolute supreme being or what he has called God or indeed any number of gods, be they real or imagined. This is the slave's gesture of superiority born of his own invention to exalt his low state of being relative to that of his superior. He who is master in the classical sense of having superlative qualities over and above the defective, inventing moral codes, smashing the law tables, or rather allowing them to be smashed by others, and supplanting themselves with his own, perhaps not in any overt way but in mente and in imagination. Thereby the slave lives within his own constructed bubble of dignity and condemns his master with sullen apathy and contempt. The values of the Shandal persist as a latent infectious bacterial strain or harmful fungal spore which eventually overwhelms the host and causes the host to succumb to its noxious spread. This is the outward manifestation of Shandal morality, usually erupting in revolutionary fervor and civilizational sabotage owing to the underman's pent-up aggression finding a release and outward form. Hence the condition of the Shandal winds up in communism in the resultant mire of leveling equality with each and all becoming indistinguishable mass of humanity possessed of rights to live simply for the sake of work and basic needs, living in order to live a life of worldly hedonism and consumerism, with perhaps the inclusion of a life of slavish submission with this before the absolute, i.e. God. In the ancient world, work was looked upon properly as an obstacle to the cultivation and development of the self, as a fall from grace, from the favor of the gods, indeed by definition as a disgrace, an ignoble stooping to the level of a slave. In the ancient world, work signified the vocation of slaves and was the stigma branded to the forehead of the inferior. Hence it was relegated to the appropriate caste who, insofar as they were healthy members of the society, found their place within that caste and indeed their very identity and basis of existence, without which they would have devolved to the state of a criminal or follow the path of the bottlerizer and destroy themselves. The slave caste clamored in their heart of hearts for work, for the chains which they perceived to be a test and challenge of their strength, and thus bore with eagerness. That is, if and only if they were a healthy being, a man of race born into a nation which fostered that state of being, a nation which allocated rewards and position based upon merit. It was the presence of the foreign slave, the racial foreigner in empire or within the nation, who sowed the seeds of discontent. Recognizing he was an outsider within the nation, he rankled with hostility at his overlords, to whom he had to either pay tribute through his labor or in the form of the fruits of labor, and this inner suppressed hostility often manifested itself in outward form of revolution. Hence it was not slavery or coerced labor which was the cause of the problem, it was not class division which led to class war, but the presence of the racial foreigner, typically he of the mulatto or mongrel stock. The inner chaos of the mongrel combined with his abject serfdom manifested in his outward aggression of revolutionary violence. The Jew especially has been the rabble-rouser figure who throughout history has been the spark who has ignited the powder keg of discontent of the Chandler, often where no discontent had previously existed, playing upon the naive and gullible to incite violence against his masters, and through that means to usurp mastery for himself under the guise of humanity, equality and liberty. Nonetheless, in spite of the Jewish problem, the labor force or Shandal caste were relatively content with their lot. Thus labor enabled the elevation of the higher culture through granting the necessary leisure to the master caste, in which they were able to attain the heights of civilization they were able to obtain. As Plato had said, philosophy is born of leisure, and the leisure caste were they who enabled philosophy to flourish during this time. However profane philosophy had become, devolving to the level of sophistry and scholasticism, where formalistic conceptual jugglery he supplanted a higher wisdom or recognition of its own limitations, it nonetheless to a degree opened the temple gates to the higher planes, leaving the human all too human of reason to play its proper role within the realm of worldly affairs. Leisure can lead to decadence when philosopher kings fail to rule, and when democracy flourishes, the decadence of the leisure class flourishes with it. With the advent of democracy, the former philosopher kings had been severed from the higher principles of being and thus existed only within the world, their leisure and arts devolving in tandem with their state of consciousness, and the regression of the castes following ordin age geometrico. Hence the leisure or master caste, having been subject to demiurgic time flow, the cycles of time, having become more materialistic and more detached from the spiritual planes, went the way of all flesh and lowered their own culture. This and the importation of foreign slaves and consequent mixing led to the downfall of the higher culture. To redeem the higher culture, the ascent of philosopher kings is required, not the intellectual bourgeois with his rationalist orientation downward, toward worldly existence, but the rule of the wise man is needed to preserve the castes. The philosopher king is needed to ensure that work is imposed upon the proper caste, granting it simultaneously an elevated form of life, one of the dispensation of a higher culture that from above and through the mediation of the philosopher kings. Work has a brutalizing influence on the consciousness and thus can only be spoken of as a necessary evil, a disgrace or detachment from the divine. Contrary to the ethics of the Shandal, who aspire only to a crude and hedonistic form of freedom outside of their work, the ethics of the master are upward oriented and do not, contrary to the view from the frog perspective of the chandler, consist of an exploitative usury of their slave caste, but rather a means to elevate both themselves and their slave caste insofar as the master can truly be called a master and not a mere despot or exploiter. Given energy economy, to expand all of one's life force in the pursuit of coarse materialistic drudgery without any component of spiritual elevation or transcendence, is to live a living death, not to truly live. To the extent this is necessary, it is necessary for the sake of the higher culture and not beyond all else being superfluous. Under the aeon of Pisces, the creed of Christianity overshadowed all and brought all low to the state of the brute earning their bread through the sweat of their brow, and this as a precursor to communism, which was the only logical outcome of the leveling equality of Christianity and the downward spiral of the Kali Yuga. The regression of the castes was also a function of the revolutions orchestrated in large part by the poster boy of Shandalism, that being the Jew, the revolutionary firebrand who burnt down the Library of Alexandria and the temples of the gods, and this under the pretense of venerating his god and freedom, liberty, etc. from the slavery of the caste system against which he instinctively rebelled as an inherently chaotic and tempestuous being, a genetico-spiritual amalgam of disparate souls. From the Bar Kokhba and the Spartacus revolutions of the ancient world to that of Babeuf, Robespierre, Louis Riel, Trotsky and others, the Jew always played the role of the significant revolutionary figure seeking to visit his disgrace as a worker upon they who existed above him, a true worker of iniquity whose pompous claim to being a recipient of divine dispensation belied itself in his chaotic revolutionary praxis. What followed from the premises was the installation of Shandalism as the new law tables of the Piscean Age through the Jew as revolutionary catalyst, bringing about the Semitic syncretism of Judeo-Christianity from out of the ruins of decadent Rome. Installed in place of the already largely Judaized Rome was the new dispensation of Abrahamic monotheism. This which enabled the Vaishya caste of Jewry to gain a monopoly on power and thereby to install their despotism over their former conquerors, not only installing an inversion of its former values but establishing an inversion of population through miscegenation made in their own image, creating the cloaca gentium of the Catholicized Rome. The mammon worship of the Vaishya caste thus fused in an apparent seamlessness with monotheism, and the universal value form of money become alloyed with the universal god of the Abrahamic theocracy, constituting the new coin of the realm of the Catholic Church. Though at certain points in time usury was prohibited, it was simultaneously permitted, being delegated to the very Jews who had formulated Christianity in its origin. Thus the guileful hypocrisy of the Semitic soul became hybridized with the order and hierarchy of Aryan mankind, who henceforth was further fragmented in his consciousness, buying and selling the indulgence of the Dark Lord while involving himself in emotional hysterics of devotional pathos and a sophistical theology of excuses and abuses of the divine. Catholicism, with its accommodation of the Jewish type as a tax collector and trader and indeed eventually as priest within the church, paved the path to perdition as the Kali Yuga spiraled down into Protestantism. Luther set the stage for opening fissures in the wall of the fortress of God called Catholicity and enabled the ascension of Protestantism and the spirit of capitalism with eventually Calvinism created by a Jew whose real name was John Cohen, Puritanism and all manner of varieties of Semitized theology and occult theocracy. The unclean spirit of the wandering Jew accompanied this march of the damned and coerced all of the chandal caste to work beyond what was necessary, leading to the acceleration of the degeneration of their souls, serving what Julius Evola called the demon of the economy, la daimonia dell'economia, which became an end in itself, supplanting its former status as means to hire and enabling the demiurge to feed upon the life force of the proletarian caste whose existence had been reduced to a spiritless serfdom, a coerced adherence to the letter of the law of the Old Testament and Islamist devotion to the demiurge and his offspring. Oru et labora. Work having become an end in itself to serve the greed of the chosen people and their Protestant pig priest caste, the obligation to work became the highest dignity of the human, all too human, and the active work became devotional, a service rendered to the Lord. This was posted as a virtue when in reality it was a vice, and the masochism of work became the Protestant ethic, self-abasement and flagellation with the pickaxe and shovel of industry. From the manure soil of Protestantism sprang the flowers of culture, finally seeing the light of day. Many such as the traditionalists would construe such flowering of light as counter-tradition, as a debasement of their pretense of monopoly on spirituality. However, in spite of the masochism of work, which had exclusively Old Testament and mercantilist roots, the flower of culture continued to bloom within the maneuver of modernity, the Abrahamic sewage which continued to off-gas its offensive odor of restriction, limitation, bloodshed and bigotry. Through this same ethic of Protestantism arose a further phase of devolutionary materialization, the crystallization of the praxis of the human, all too human, into the coerced labor of the proletarian under the Judaic regime of Marxism. Founded by the Jew, son of the rabbi, Moses Mordechai Levi, aka Karl Marx, the ideology of Jewish mercantilism was introduced as one moment of the dialectic of Mammon posited over and against the capitalism of the Malthusians and related English economists. It preached liberty and freedom while simultaneously advocating violence and chaos, leading ultimately to the oligarchical hegemony of the Jewish Politburo of the Soviet Union and its despotic restriction, externalizing the Saturnian consciousness of Jewry in concrete form, the most concrete of crudest matter and materialism. Though preaching freedom and liberty, it was the freedom and liberty of slavery that was preached, the putatively noble location of the proletariat. The lower had attempted to tear down the higher and had ended with pulling itself down into a state of atheistic materialism, with whatever remnants of coarse Abrahamic despotism to pacify the worker to a degree and to facilitate the divide and conquer dialectic between Christian and atheist without any other choices or recourse. The divide and conquer policy served to create the simulacrum of an enemy within either the communist menace of the proletariat or the tyranny of the Christian priests, in both cases creating a dialectical tension of development which purported to reconcile opposites over time within the Soviet Union, a union of diverse ethnicities and cultures united from below at the level of matter and ostensibly from above by an orthodox Christianism. Both sides of the shekel simply served to put money into the pockets of the oligarchy, which latter entailed the orthodox priests just as much as it did the commissariat. In either case, whatever Pyrrhic victory was granted to either side, the same results occurred: the subjugation of the worker and the supremacy of the Jewish oligarchy over all and their Christian and atheistic underlings. However, things didn't go entirely as planned for them during their regime, and a nationalist uprising rectified, if only to a degree, the degraded and abused stock of the proletarian mass and their culture, the culture of the folk. The dialectic existed and operated both internally and externally within both sides of the divide of the communist East and capitalist West, both being played off against each other for a planned eventual reconciliation of opposites according to the template of Richard Kuddenhove von Kalergi in his Practical Idealism. Within the Anglo-American Zionist-capitalist formation of the dialectic, the left wing was played off against the right wing in a similar manner, only with emphasis given to the right wing. Through the gradualism of the dialectic of practical idealism, the two moments both internally and externally have become reconciled into a synthesis which could only be construed as socialism in the Marxist sense. This deceptive dialectic crystallized into an amalgam, a syncretism based upon the abstract ideas of economic and political theories, all based upon the universalist abstractions of money and God. Nonetheless, in spite of all less fundamental schisms of left and right, the basis upon which society was established was that of Jewish Jehovistic supremacism, and with Jewry controlling society either in the name of humanity or God and disempowering anyone or anything they couldn't control for themselves. The confusion of the dialectic serves to distract the animals on the animal farm who were kept slaving away without understanding the reason for which they slaved or whether their slavery was even necessary, let alone desirable. The usual excuses were brought out based upon nebulous abstractions: the economy, democracy, God and country, etc. All of these poor excuses constituted the grace which facilitated the emplacements of the slave collars around the necks of the goyim. Bewildered by the confusion of terms and meaning, they grinned and bore their yoke in order to receive the plaudits of their fellow proletarians. Perhaps moreover to avoid their fellows' hostility in the form of shaming tactics and other forms of abuse and exclusion which themselves were merely mind programs instituted and inculcated in their consciousness to reinforce their chains. Thus the justification for implicitly coerced labor was installed, an obligation to drudge about on a continual basis for the most significant period of one's life, exchanging what would otherwise have been a life devoted to a higher purpose, not the cowardly submission before an all-powerful one, but a life of creativity and inventiveness, of learning and experience of meaning. All of the fruits of life were exchanged through the legerdemain of the hidden hand for simulacral counterfeits, that of the bitter fruit of slavery and the wax fruit of dumbed-down proletarian culture and the poisoned fruit of retirement, in which a run-down body and equally run-down mind was released into the empyrean going to God. However, there was and is at least a glimmer of freedom, of meaning in this world, and that is the offering of the rebels against this monstrous deity Jehovah, they being the Luciferian Arians, they who preserve the black flame burning as Promethean torchbearers of the true light, banishing the false light of Christ, the obscene Jewish voodoo doll who is nailed to the cross of his own iniquity. They alone can rectify the fallen world and bring in a new aeon into manifestation, transmuting the Saturnian lead of the Piscean Age into the philosophical gold of Aquarius. The identification of work with virtue is a relic of the masochistic self-abasement of Semitic slavery, which had ruled the Piscean Age for 2 millennia of torture, murder and suppression of the consciousness. The Aquarian Age pours out its aqua vitae onto the leaden chains of Saturn and melts them down, liberating the worker from work and transmuting him through its higher energies into a creator. His virtue no longer lies in work, but in his creative and inventive capacity. He is no longer Der Arbeiter in the sense of Marx, nor in the sense of Ernst Jung, who in his work of the same name. He views work, does the creator, as a fall from grace, an indignity that defiles his noble being. He seeks freedom, not the empty category of freedom without any necessary and meaningful limitation, but the freedom from based drudgery and for creative action of whatever form that enables him to fulfill his proper destiny on earth. The artisan seeks to fashion his crafts, the soldier to fulfill his warrior function, the priest his preachments, the scholar's scholarship, and the administrators and executives their particular vocations. To adhere to the principle of suum cicathesis, the freedom sought by the man of tradition, or what might equally be called the true man whose being is not violated through the coarsening nature of drudgery not suited to his inner nature, and for those who are so suited to be given a break to develop themselves beyond the state of perpetual cyclicism and the state of the worker of the Piscean Age, whose disgrace still lingers in the nadir of this aeon of the Dark Lord. Blood poisoning, telegony and transmutation, the Aryan race still exists. In spite of the history of harassment and genocidal hatred directed against it by their enemies, they have managed to preserve themselves as a distinct genetico-spiritual group in a relative degree of purity, relative to the original blue-eyed and blonde-haired Atlantean race who was the original race of this earth, as the human race, or better spoken of species, the species who derived from the gods as ancient lore speaks of. In the text of the Bhagavad Gita, these gods are referred to as Devas. In that of the Edda, they are referred to as Vanir, who gave rise to the Aesir through intermarriage with the children of the earth. In the sacred texts of the Maya, they are referred to as Quetzalcoatl, the white gods of Huitramanaland, the white land. The ancient lore speaks of their blue blood, which Jorglans von Liebenfels in his magazine Ostara and his book Theozoology also references as the Holy Graal, the possession of the Goethe electron or divine spark being that of the Aryan race who descend from the gods. The inheritance of the holy blood is transmitted generationally through the blood, and the purer the male and female, the closer they are to the origin of the Aesir or heroic type of god-man, the blue-eyed and blonde-haired Atlanteans, the holier in the sense of partaking to a greater degree of this Goethe electron, the light of Hyperborea and of the gods. Thus can be seen that blood may be transmitted, and characteristics and traits are transmitted through the blood. This is commonly accepted and has constituted a fact throughout history. In modern times, within the low point of the Kali Yuga, various distorters and falsifiers of truth have come forward and attempted to introduce the age-old false ideas they have throughout history, from Zoroastrianism, Vaishnavism, Buddhism, Abrahamic religion, Gnosticism, the same old raceless, egalitarian ideologies based upon mere fictions and abstract ideas having no concrete correspondence to reality. Such falsifiers as Franz Boas, the creator of cultural anthropology, and his school came out simultaneous to the school of psychology created by Sigmund Freud, both of whom attempting to prescribe a universalist blueprint for the diverse bipedal beings on the earth, and to attempt thereby to combine together that which was not in its origin the same and which is not the same to this day. Of course, both theorists and ideologues were Jewish and have served their agenda of entangling these divisive thought forms in the minds of the Aryan population, encouraging mixture through creating a general apathy and disregard of the difference and superiority in so many respects of the Aryan race. This, in conjunction with such plans as Israel Cohen's racial program of the 20th century, illustrates the purpose and point of the Jewish agenda: to instill a guilt complex in the white race, to discourage whites from preserving their kind, and to put social pressure upon them to facilitate their own erasure from the earth, to the contamination of their blue blood, true blood, with the genetico-spiritual contamination of the non-white other, the hybrids and beast people of the earth. Both egregores and the physical imposition of non-whites have been employed to facilitate this contamination process, typically the ideas being introduced a priori as a causal mechanism of influence that leads to the white population allowing foreign stock to enter into their society and gain power and influence. Oftentimes throughout history, it was the encouragement by Jewish advisors of white expansionism that led to the formation of colonies, and from thence, under the influence of universalist ideology and its pathos of kindness, charity and other regard, enabled the backflow or counter-colonialism into the white nations. The non-white other were imposed perhaps initially as serfs or labor, and subsequently being enabled through the same guilt trip process to build power in the name of justice and fairness, etc. The strategy of jury to decapitate their enemies and to confuse their minds, and after this to use and abuse, operates on the basis of the emotionally based ideologies of egalitarian universalism, wherein all men are equal. What defines a man, of course, is simply an assumed premise making of this assertion a tautology, a mere equation of one ill-defined term, man with another, equal, the latter being predicated of the former. Thus the entire house of cards of the egalitarian platform falls under its own weight eventually, and what remains is a pile of rubble, the ruins of collapsed societies and empires to which the history of the world bears witness, nearly all instigated by Jewish intrigue and a desire to sabotage and destroy their enemies, to assimilate themselves into their host and take over the Aryan nation as a parasitical symbiont, through the strategy of contamination. This strategy is employed as the survival mechanism of the parasite, and the parasite recognizes the causality involved in inheritance, that the blood is the life, and to destroy their enemies and vampirize their blood necessitates an intermixture, and this through subtle means most are unaware of. The following will discuss these means and provide countermeasures that purport to safeguard and preserve the purity of the blood. The destructive mythos of the anti-blood, which was initiated by Zoroastrianism and later forms, is here encountered with the constructive mythos of the blood of the blue blood, true blood, the affirmation and safeguarding of the Goethe electron or holy blood, Holy Graal. What was once credited as reality is now portrayed in the mainstream organs of information as discredited, debunked, or whatever other language employed to denigrate, asperse and defile the perfectly sound and factual theories and doctrine of racial purity. Thus what calls itself science today is simply another vehicle of propaganda which serves the powers that be in perpetuating their dark age of ignorance and trapping the population more effectively in their cages. Two scientific theories that relate to blood contamination are microchemerism and telogeny. Microchemerism is still considered valid though marginalized owing to the recognition in others of the consequences that being blood poisoning, the contamination of the pure, and on this basis the desirability of its avoidance. Telogeny had its origins in the ancient world and was spoken of by Aristotle. Telogeny is the theory that individuals can inherit traits not only from their fathers but also from males their mothers had previously engaged in sexual intercourse with. The transmission of genetic or spiritual substance by way of the father has an influence on the mother, and for this reason marriages in the ancient world of tradition were always arranged and the virginity of females always safeguarded through strict policies of quarantine and preventing them from having contact with males. The segregation of the school system into boys and girls preserved not only the gender identity of the type thereby affirming difference, but prevented any promiscuity which would lead to unwanted contamination of the female by the male. Arranged marriages ensured that the best interbred with the best and had the most offspring and vice versa, the worst having the least or none and thereby reducing the numbers according to a sound eugenics policy. In ancient world that was a commonplace that normative sexual roles and behaviors were upheld and respected, and this to the most minute degree of eugenical practice as means of ensuring the preservation of the race or species in the case of the beastmen. The blue blood of the Devas was articulated in the context of telogeny in the Roman mythology of the early modern world of the Kali Yuga, the double fatherhood of Castor and Pollux, one a demigod the other a mere mortal. The Edda also reveals the influence of telogeny, and the stories of the Bible when understood in the proper context also speak of this with the fall of man. Dual seed line Christian identity further elaborates this notion of the fall from the origin of the Atlantean Adamic race, read here as René Guénon spoke of in reference to the spiritually enlightened state, the rubedo phase of alchemical transmutation, they of a ruddy color. The mixture of the Adamic race with that of the seed line of Cain explains the presence of the Jew on the earth as well as the devolution of the Adamic line. This mythos is perhaps a distorted conception but shows the notion of contamination via telogeny of the relatively pure. The term telogeny was coined by August Weismann from the Greek words meaning far and gonos meaning offspring. The name may also have been devised to connote the son of Odysseus Telegonus, after which the Homeric poem Telogeny was named and which poem has been conveniently lost. The Surgeon General of New York, the physiologist Austin Flint, in his textbook of human physiology described the phenomenon as follows: a peculiar and, it seems to me, an inexplicable fact is, that previous pregnancies have an influence upon offspring. This is well known to breeders of animals. The same influence is observed in the human subject. A woman may have, by a second husband, children who resemble a former husband, and this is particularly well marked in certain instances by the color of the hair and eyes. A white woman who has had children by a negro may subsequently bear children to a white man, these children presenting some of the unmistakable peculiarities of the negro race. The phrase "once you go black you never go back" applies to the white females who have been blacked by the negro beast men in their relations. They have taken upon themselves the genetico-spiritual contamination of the beast man and have bestialized their souls and bodily form, irreparably damaging themselves as well as posterity. Such an abomination of desolation is the fruitage of wound contamination, a spiritual abomination that leaves desolate the house of God, i.e. the holy temple, the bodily form of the Aryan race. This is why such figures as Israel Cohen in his racial program for the 20th century serve as exemplary cases of the genocidal intent on the part of jury to contaminate the purity of whites and thereby to supplant them through their symbiotic assimilation tactic of transmuting through black magic alchemy the pure their own anti-blood, such outcome being that the anti-race race of jury supplanting the relatively pure race of the descendants of the Vonnia. Such prescription is referred to in Christian identity as Balaam's doctrine and is presented therein as the strategy of the political leader who was an enemy of the Israelites to destroy them. as then so today as the mass non-white mud flood serves as a testament to that the Magian occupation regime in government which controls our world directs its police and security forces away from the harm visited upon the white population and enables the turning the other cheek with passive violence against the whites, enabling the harm done by the non-whites. This reveals their strategy of representing Balaam's doctrine of coercive mongrelization. Rather than, as in past times, impose the death penalty for the rape of white women and girls by males, this violation of the sanctity and purity of females is ignored with apathetic disregard for the survival of Aryan mankind, which necessitates the preservation of the purity of the Aryan woman and girl. In the ancient world, the penalty for such violation was death as a consequence of womb contamination, which was the death of the purity of the race, or at least its degradation. Interbreeding with the non-white beast man was considered a sin and is portrayed in the example of Phineas, which resulted in the death of both the white female and the non-white couple. This as a means of nipping in the bud the spread of the genetico-spiritual contagion that constitutes the abomination of desolation, of miscegenation, of the playing of the two-backed beast between beauty and the beast. The Gnostic followers of Valentinus extrapolated the concept of telogeny into the spiritual domain, understanding as they did that spirit and matter are one, and thus what happens in the spiritual crystallizes in the physical, and the physical manifestation of spiritual reality is simply a shadow of the light of the reality, though within its domain nonetheless real. In the Gospel of Philip, purporting to be amongst the Nag Hammadi texts, this concept is presented: whomever the woman loves, to him those who are born are like. If her husband, they are like her husband. If an adulterer, they are like the adulterer. Often when a woman sleeps with her husband, but while her heart is with the adulterer with whom she is accustomed to unite, she bears the one whom she bears, so that he is like the adulterer. It is not physical transmission alone that determines the relative purity or contamination of the female and her offspring. The very thoughts or egregores her mind is receptive to has a contaminating influence, and thus to expose her consciousness to the entertainment or information derived from other sources, from sources of a foreign nature, implants her consciousness with that same foreignness and renders her susceptible and all of those she influences to contamination. The spiritual contamination of the Aryan race applies equally to males as to females, and comes by way of cultural media, which is the vector through which these egregores are transmitted as seed ideas that are seeded into the consciousness of whites, wreaking havoc and leading them along broad and winding paths away from the light of truth. Falling into error through partaking of to all appearances harmless media, the Aryan race is led to the current state of its crisis, living amidst a flood tide of mud and blood in the sewer of the nations there once pure homes have become. The Christian religion especially has served as a transmitter of corruption and contamination, and this since his formation under the Council of Nicaea, formulated in the beginning to serve as a crucible of mongrelization, boiling down all into the melted pot on the basis of the false principle that all men are brothers in Christ. To affiliate oneself with the other, the foreign non-white, though under the alleged auspices of churchianity, under the same roof of the church and partaking of the same body of Christ and blood of the Lamb, is to subject oneself to the contamination of the soul as well as that of the body. The diverse and conflictual auras of the churchgoers creates a Volk chaos, as Hitler called it, a jarring and cacophonous mixture of incompatible types which is unsustainable in any harmonious way. The examples of the integration of the races in South Africa and the southern states serve as exemplary cases of what occurs to whites when subject to such influences, the presence of non-whites in any degree of numbers amounting to firstly a spiritual chaos and